Welcome, welcome, and thank you for joining us wherever you are listening. This podcast is sponsored by Cooker 100 Degree Boiling Hot Water straight from your kitchen tap. Mine also does chilled filtered water and chilled sparkling filtered water whenever anyone comes around. Not that we're allowed to right now because it's locked down again, but when people do and I say, do you want some sparkling water, and they see it come out of my tap, it's like I'm doing a magic trick or something. It's always fantastic watching people's reaction. Well, that's coming out of your tap. Yeah, it is. Yeah. Thank you, Cooker, for supporting the podcast. And it's great. We're sponsored by such a fantastic product. That's what I think. Anyway, for more details, go to cooker.co.uk. Cooker spelled Q-U-O-O-K-E-R. Today's podcast is another celebrity special. 19 questions to Connie Huck. And if I like them, she will get the bonus question. I'm a big fan of Connie's. Whenever she comes on Sunday brunch, she's just a pure delight. She's always fun. She's always interesting. There's nothing you can't ask her. It's, I don't know, she's one of those guests where when someone says, Connie's on, you're like, oh, brilliant. This is just like, don't have to work. It's just easy. In recent years, she's turned her hand to writing children's books. I think she's got three in the series she's going to be doing. She's already done Cookie and the Most Annoying Boy in the World and Cookie and the Most Annoying Girl in the World. And she's recently had another book out called Fearless Fairy Tales. So we'll speak to her about that. Let's meet her. Here's Connie. Welcome, Connie. Thank you for joining me today.
Pleasure. Lovely to be on.
I had Adam Kay on my podcast the other day, and we were both singing your praises, saying how much we enjoy your company. And you wrote Fearless Fairy Tales with his husband, didn't you, James Kay?
Yeah, so his husband, James Kay, who used to be in comedy at the BBC, because it's a very, very funny story. Funny book. We co-wrote it because we thought that the fairy tales of today need updating for the 21st century. So they're all sort of traditional fairy tales, but with modern takes. So for instance, there's Sleeping Brainy, whose dad, the king, wants her to be a princess, but she wants to be Chancellor of the Exchequer. There's Trumpelstiltskin, who speaks for himself, funny orange man, money obsessed. There's Gretel and Hansel, who work in a sweet shop but aren't getting paid equally. You know, it's just funny stories. The gingerbread kid, whose people are being eaten in fairy tale land. So he flees across the sea in a boat to the UK, where he gets bullied at a school till they realise he's really interesting because he's got stories of giants and beanstalks and cats in boots. But, you know, it's all tongue-in-cheek and laugh out loud because we want kids to have a good sense of humour as well.
Did you read a lot as a kid?
Do you know what? I have a confession to make. I was what we call a reluctant reader. So I used to think reading wasn't for me. And I used to find it a chore and I used to find it boring. And basically, I remember really clearly we had to read The Iron Man by Ted Hughes at school. And I just thought it was really boring. Oh, I probably shouldn't say that because it's probably a real classic. And I found it quite creepy. And I decided that, you know, reading was just for other people. And then one day, a couple of years later, I think it was, at wet break, we had to pick up a book from the bookshelf at school, and I picked up this book called Super Fudge by Judy Blume. And it was the first book that I just devoured cover to cover that had no pictures in, and it was written how I thought grown-up books were written. So it wasn't patronising, and there was no magic in it or, you know, wizards or giants or anything like that. So it felt very grown up to me. But that was what I call my gateway book, and loads of people don't find their gateway book. And if they don't find it as a kid, then they'll be adults that aren't into reading, they'll never get into reading because it will be like a chore, it'll be like a foreign language.
Yeah, I never used to read as a kid. I used to, whenever there was a ball around, that's what I'd be doing. I'd be kicking balls constantly. But now I love books, and I can't, it's once you get into them and you realize the sort of books you like reading. And I always say now, I read this once and I think you're never alone if you've got a good book. And it's so true that if you're ever feeling slightly miserable, if you know you've got, like you've got a good Netflix series, if you know you've got a good book sitting there waiting. My twins' insatiable appetite for reading could not. I mean, literally, I was like the dad out of Matilda. I used to say, put those books down, because they just wouldn't stop reading. Whereas my youngest has not really found reading yet. But I've got to say this. Adam Kay's book is really hitting home with her because she likes reading about the body. And because it's all about, and he's quite humorous with it, all the blood and the gore. I'm going to have to get your book as well. Because
I'm going to send you this one. And then, honestly, she'll love it. How old is she?
Seven.
Yeah, it's really, because it's funny again. It's really, yeah, really humorous. And so, yeah, I think she'll like it. And also, what's really good about it is each of the stories is short enough for you to just read a whole one before bedtime.
Perfect.
And if she's into kicking balls about, she'll like Snow White and the Five-A-Side Football Team, you see, because, perfect, you know, so there's something for everyone.
And what's happened with Cookie? We've read Cookie and the Most Annoying Boy. I read that.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah, because Cookie, I'd say she's, well, seven. Yeah, if she's a good reader, then seven is perfect.
No, I read those to her. That's what I did.
Yeah, I was going to say them. She might be a bit young for Cookie. But yeah, Cookie's funny as well. But yeah, this one is just a perfect sort of bedtime read. And it's humour. It's another thing that's a gateway. Anything that gets kids into reading is a good thing. And if they can come in through the back door through humour or through funny pictures or because they love the subject matter of a book, it's so important because studies have shown that kids that read go further in life.
I think it gives you a really good base as well for all your knowledge and all your learning. You know, you've got to learn the times table and how to read, and then you're halfway there, I think, with everything.
Yeah, totally. That's homeschooling sorted, if it comes back.
Is that, I get my daughter to stand on a chair reciting her times table. I don't know why I get her to stand on a chair, but it seems to indicate to her we're going to do the times table. But it's a struggle, and she doesn't enjoy it. But I keep on saying, once you've learned the times table, maths becomes a lot easier. So
Yeah. Know.
Once you
I'm the same with my son. Is your daughter year three, right?
Yeah,
because my son's year four, and I'm like, you should know your times table by now. And he hates it. He just, I have to think of funny rhymes. We have all these weird songs like 5, 6, 7, 8, 56 is 7 times 8, and like weird sort of things.
That's brilliant.
Well, once they know their 2s, their 5s, and their 10s, they can often work out lots of different ones, but the 7s and the 8s are particularly difficult because you can't just add on from doing a 5 times table or take away from doing a 10 times table. So the 7s and the 8s are the ones that I try and lock down with him.
Yeah, you've got to try and the 7s and the 8s, you've got to try, well, all of them, you've got to memorize it so that you, that as soon as it happens.
Yeah.
I mean, we're all still bad, aren't we, as parents? I can't memorize the whole of mine, but I mean, I know them pretty much. Right, well, what's going to happen in the third book on Cookie then? So we've got Cookie, the Most Annoying Boy, Cookie, the Most Annoying Girl. There's three, isn't there?
So Annoying Boy is the introductory book, sort of about knowledge and education and science. Annoying Girl is about saving the environment and climate change and eco warriors. And then the next one is all about coding and hacking and computers, problem solving and puzzles. So that's actually the first draft is due in right now, but it's overdue. So that's what I will be doing after I get off this call. But you see, anything to not have to do it. Hence, I was like, yes, Tim's podcast. Woohoo!
All right, well, let's go on with these questions then, see how you get on with them, right?
Okay.
Question number one, what's the one piece of advice you'd like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
Happiness comes from helping each other, not helping yourself. So, you know, you think you're happy by, I don't know, getting the iPhone 1000, but then it becomes outdated and you just want the 2000, then the 3000, it never stops. Or you think, I don't know, getting lots of likes for a tweet or a Instagram, or, you know, having more trendy clothes or having more money or more power. But there'll always be someone that has more. And once you subscribe to that mentality, you're just sort of keeping up with the Joneses the whole time. And actually, happiness comes through having really good friends, you know, a partner that you get on, people interactions, because helping each other is so sort of fulfilling. It sounds a bit hippy-clippy.
No, it doesn't at all. they've done some scientific tests on that, haven't they? And they give someone $100 and they say, spend it on half of them spend it on themselves and half of them spend it on other people. And the happiness levels are a lot higher with the people who've spent that $100 on somebody else. It always makes you feel better. How did you find that out yourself, or did you read all that stuff?
I think it's just because I'm quite anti-consumerism. And there came a point, so, you know, I got my job on Blue Peter quite young, so fresh out of university. And then at that age, you're sort of really into fashion and you're really into having coolest clothes and being cool and doing cool things and having cool objects and all of that stuff. And I think that when you get to your 30s, you're kind of more confident in who you are and in yourself. So you're not just trying to please other people. you kind of don't have to do that anymore because you're not, you know, young and naive and trying to be accepted. And I think that's when I sort of realized, and also the whole climate change thing is like, I don't need all that stuff. And I honestly have the most happiness when I'm just laughing with people or just surrounded by people that are fun. And none of the rest, and I'd rather have like really, I don't know, untrendy clothes and a horrible house or whatever and friends that don't judge me on it than the pressure of having to, you know, have everything perfect and nice just to please other people, if that makes sense.
Yeah, you say people get to their 30s and realize they don't have to impress people, but I'm not sure that's a very wise thing to do. I'm not sure everybody buys into that. I mean, if you look at just, for instance, the Kardashians, the biggest thing on TV, I mean, that woman just in the middle of a pandemic flew 40 friends to an island and like with ridiculous expense. I mean, it made me feel quite sick looking at it. And
yeah, it's so gross. That is so gross.
But people are still buying into this. When my daughter started watching it, I used to say, live your own life. Stop living her life, for God's sake. You know, you've got as much, you've got one life. Stop living Kardashian's life. Okay, that goes on to an interesting, the next question then. What does success mean to you, Connie?
Well, I'm going to sound so happy clappy, like I said, but success is being happy, because actually, what more can you want in life than being happy? And everyone is happy. So like, people do think success comes from having a better job, or like I say, all these benchmarks, having more followers, having more money, having more clothes, having more this, more that. But if you're happy, you're winning. And even if you're happy and you know, and if you're surrounded by happy people as well, obviously you're ultimately winning when the world is happy.
Is it hard for you though, because talking about success terms, you were on Blue Peter when people were still watching Blue Peter. You know, I remember I remember you coming on, I think it might have been Something for the Weekend at the time, or maybe it was Sunday Brunch.
Yeah.
And my daughters could not believe that you were the most famous person they'd ever seen. They just couldn't believe it was Connie Hart. And they kept looking at you, peering around the door, looking at you. It was so, Blue Peter was absolutely huge then, wasn't it? Is it tough when you get such major success so young?
You know what? Really, what I do think is good about Blue Peter, because actually at the time there were programs like this going back into The Word and, you know, sort of cool programs like that, which also had presenters in their 20s. I mean, I was admittedly fresh out of uni on Blue Peter, but what's good about Blue Peter is it's kind of, you know, I always say Blue Peter is woke before woke. If you think about it, it had a Blue Peter appeal before, you know, comic relief was even a thing. It had a Blue Peter garden for people that live in a high rise and they don't have their own garden. You know, I went and saw people, you know, in sub-Saharan Africa that were sort of living in barter economies because there was no money. And, you know, one day you're interviewing a prime minister, but then the next day you're down a sewer. And, you know, Blue Peter is what I call the university of television, because everyone is expected to muck in. And it's all really young, like-minded people. I remember as well, us turning up at Buckingham Palace to go filming. And literally, I think they sort of opened the doors to us and thought, what is this? The YTS scheme for making telly? Because literally, everyone's really young. And so you're given this kind of quite a lot of freedom to make these films and make this TV show. But you're also sort of still at that age where sort of you've got idealism. And, you know, I do think it's almost like not like getting a job on normal telly. It keeps you really grounded. They definitely, you know, they will not hesitate to stick you down a sewer. You can't feel like you're famous on Blue Peter at all. Because, you know, you really have to get stuck in. You know, you don't just film something. You have to, like, do the training. So I had to, you know, I did got my rally driver's license, but it meant I had to every weekend, often at midnight, because that's when the roads are clear, do a qualifying rally to get my UK rally driver's license. So you can't just pitch up like the Kardashians and get your makeup done and go on. You know, you have to do your paddy, you have to do the training. I had to train to become a British Airways air stewardess and do all the training with all the other people that were doing the training to actually get the job. So you have to actually do the graft. I did the Royal Marines training course and it was horrible. And I'm really, you know, not fit like those people. So there's quite a lot of humiliation and hardship.
I was obsessed with wanting to be a Blue Peter presenter. You know, I got to audition That was one of the first things I ever did. And,
wow.
And it was like, I didn't get it. Obviously, I wasn't suitable for it. I didn't really have the skills, if I'm truthful with you. And I sort of did this audition and they asked me to come back and present Blue Peter. Well, they not come back, but present Blue Peter for a charity thing. And I did it.
Yeah.
I can't remember what that was. And then they showed my audition. They dug it out. And it was the only time on TV that I had no words left because it'd been so long ago. And I actually thought I'd probably made it up. And I'm watching myself do that whole trampoline thing they used to get you to do, you know, present on a trampoline and that.
Yeah.
I did actually audition for this. And my life had gone so far away from Blue Peter audition.
Yeah, yeah.
Soccer Air, onto Something for the Weekend, onto, you know, all the other things, Sunday Brunch, etc. But the only thing I think about that things like that. I interview a lot of footballers and spend a lot of time around sportsmen, and I feel sorry for them because their lives are so front loaded. Like if you're Messi, you're going to retire within the next 5 years, maybe. Then you're never going to be like as good as you were.
Yeah,
it's all front, and it must be a really hard living out the next 50 years of your life going, I used to be Messi. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you know what? But that's what I mean. Like everyone judges everyone on the now. And actually, you know, I have this thing that I call Tim Henman syndrome that I think society is really guilty of, in that Tim Henman is brilliant at tennis.
Yeah.
He was the best in the UK. And, you know, every person that he played in this whole country couldn't, you know, beat him on a regular basis or whatever because he was the best. But yet, nothing is enough because of, like I'm saying, people just want more and more. So, you know, it's not enough that he's that brilliant. He has to win Wimbledon or we're not happy. You know, Messi has been Messi. He's been the best. And now he should just sit back and enjoy it. But society makes you feel like you have to keep going the whole time because people go, oh, you had that really good job. And it's almost like the pity that people will give Messi, but he doesn't need it. If he's, you know, he's won. If he's happy, that's when you're winning.
Yeah, but Connie, I've met a lot of ex-footballers and a lot of ex-sportsmen and they're not happy because they used to be able to be the best in the world and do whatever they did and played in front of crowds and now they just...
And it's, you know why? It's because of the adulation.
Maybe.
Because then the adulation kind of, it feeds you and you think, I want more of that. It's the buzz of people know who you are and it's like a drug. You know, being on TV is almost like a drug or whatever because it's nice when people say, I love Sunday Brunch and I love what you do or whatever. But then when you're not on it anymore, I guess that stops. And so then you feel like, but those things are sort of pleasures, like getting the iPhone 1000, because real happiness is only measured by sort of love and death. I'm sounding so preachy on
it. I love it.
But you know, if someone dies, it doesn't matter if you're penniless or whether you're the richest person, that pain is just horrific. If it's someone you love, or I don't know, you get dumped or whatever it is. And same with, if I don't know, a family are laughing on holiday and having fun, whether they're in the swanky resort in Barbados or whether they're in the caravan park, that laughter is still worth the same value, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
And so that's really what you can measure. I do think COVID sort of brought that out a bit, in that if you can keep it simple, and I'm not saying we all want to go around penniless, because look, we know money helps, but there comes a limit where I actually think, and studies have shown it, you actually become more unhappy beyond a certain, what's the word? Benchmark, ceiling, level.
Yeah. I think it, what is it? I can't remember how much it was. Do you remember how much it was?
You know what? Apparently, I think it's £70,000 is the best income to be on, apparently.
Okay.
But, you know, you get these studies all the time, and stats is another thing that, because I did economics at university, I'm always dubious of stats because you can just manipulate them to say whatever you want.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I remember learning that the unemployment figures, the calculation, the statistic they used was changed 30 times in the 90s recession just because they needed to fiddle it the whole time to suit their needs.
No, government's fiddling. Right, we've got to get on with these questions.
We'll never get them. I know. I can talk to you forever, Tim. Okay,
what's the best moment of your career?
It would have to be getting my job on Blue Peter, because it was the dream job and it changed everything. I was doing science A-levels, and I was, before I got into telly, I was going to become an engineer, which I'm sure I would have been happy as and stuff, but like Blue Peter, like I say, I went to flipping so many different countries, met so many people, had so many experiences. It is the dream job.
Could you believe it? Because I remember getting my job. My first job was like in TV. I did some MTV stuff. I remember getting a job on The Big Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember when they said, you've got a job, I remember just thinking, I can't believe it. I cannot believe I've got a job in proper television. I can't believe it.
Same. You're sort of going along in a dream sequence for a while. Yeah. Sort of a bit numb. Yeah, totally. I couldn't believe it.
Let's follow that up with, what's the worst moment of your career?
The worst moment of my career? I mean, I guess I would have to say leaving Blue Peter was the worst, because I, in a weird way, my whole life was on hold while I was on Blue Peter, because it's like a bubble. And I always say Blue Peter years are like dog years or something. So I don't know, if you dated someone while you're on Blue Peter and it's like a 5-year relationship, really it's probably only 1 year in real life, because you're abroad half the time. And there was one point on Blue Peter where it's 5 times a week. So it's 3 times on BBC One, and they just launched these digital channels. So Monday, Wednesday, Friday, it was on BBC One. Then on Tuesday and Thursday, it was on the CBBC channel. And so I was so busy that, you know what it's like when you're busy doing something, time just goes like that. So I always say, although I was on it for over 10 years, it only felt like 2 years or something, because it went so quickly.
Why did you leave?
So basically, because I'd been on it over a decade, and they'd tried to get rid of me before. Well, they hadn't tried to get rid of me, but a new head of children's came in. She was like, oh, Connie's been on it an awfully long time, so maybe actually we should make this her last contract. And then she left before I left. So then the editor was like, no, you're enjoying it. The viewers love you. We love having you on it. So then I got a stay of execution. And then the next time I was going to leave, I remember they were like, well, you should just stay on to your 4,000th programme. Oh, no, the 4,000th, not my 4,000th, Blue Peter's 4,000th. Because, you know, there's all these benchmarks. And then suddenly it was like, well, if you do a bit longer, you beat Valerie Singleton's record. If you do a bit longer, you've done 10 years, which is a decade. So I finally left after I'd done the decade, when my contract expired after that. Because otherwise you could stay forever. And so after a while, the items do start to repeat. And also, adults were literally coming up to me going, I grew up with you, and I was still on the same show. But I'm very much like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Well, there used to be this thing in TV where everyone said, only do a maximum of 2 years on any TV show. I remember everyone always saying this sort of like this mantra. Yeah. And then I did 11 years on Soccer AM, and I think I've done 14 on something for the weekend and Sunday brunch. Yeah. I don't know. And I'm like, I'm like Ian Beale. I don't want to leave.
I would have quite happily stayed there forever. But yeah, it's a very difficult show to do if you sort of getting married and having kids sort of thing.
Okay, let's go on to the next question then.
Yeah.
The next question is, what's the key to a good relationship?
Key to a good relationship? I think... Well, I would say, okay, am I allowed to say a couple of answers?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so a key to a good relationship is sort of compromise and not trying to change someone. Because I think people often get into a relationship and, you know, and you're on your best behaviour, aren't you, when you're dating? And then suddenly, you know, once you've clinched the deal, you sort of revert to the real you, maybe, or like you take the person for granted. And actually, you know, you've got to keep it, you know, keep true to kind of the way it was in the beginning, not suddenly think, oh, I can mold them now to me, or, you know, or, oh, now that I've got this marriage certificate in my hand, I can show my true colors or whatever. So, you know, compromise, laughter. Like, I do think having some, you know, if you're, you know, I'm always going on about happiness, but if the other person makes you, if you make each other laugh, you know, if you have fun, you know, that you're halfway there. And then, you know, I like to say these things in threes, but I don't know what the third thing is.
Do you know what? It's what's funny about what you've said there. I went out with a woman, not a million years ago. And she said, I love partying. I really like going out partying. And that was her thing. She loved it. And then we dated for quite a long time. And then for a few months or whatever. And then I was like, do you have to always go out partying? And I thought, this is my problem, not her problem.
Because
me right at the beginning, that's what she loved doing, is going out and partying. And I was trying to change her to stop partying. So
yeah, because often think, oh, well, once you're going out with me, you won't want to party anymore. But actually, you know, like I said, people are shaping and forming in those formative years. And then really, you can't be on, people are so fixed when they're sort of in their 20s onwards. Yeah. She wasn't the right one, Tim, quite blatantly.
Obviously not. Right, what group?
Her loss.
Maybe. What group are you or were you part of?
What group?
Yeah, it could be anything, like a brownies or anything, or a what was there anything you've ever joined? Political party?
Funnily enough, I've just, right, so me and my neighbours, we were all in a big group to try and stop, we've got playing fields opposite, and they're community open space protected playing fields. And the council had just okayed this development, but you know, protected green space is protected green space. And it's funny because, you know what I was saying about happiness comes from helping each other, not helping yourself. So, you know, before that, I didn't really, I mean, we've lived in this house 4 years now. And admittedly, I had two babies when we moved here. But, and so I knew my neighbours well enough. But since, you know, fighting the field being built on, you know, I know my neighbours so much better. And it's just so fun. Sort of having a common goal and doing something with people for the greater good. You know, and you know, that can be so many different things.
Did you win?
Well, this is it. This is where I wanted to say this anecdote. So the council then voted it through. So we were like, and then we appealed it at the GLA, and we had to, like, honestly get biodiversity stats, find out if there's bats roosting, like do all this stuff. Like, it's like having another full-time job or something. And we fought it. And we found out during lockdown that we've won.
Yeah.
And so then, yeah. Cause I'm so like, why build on green space when there's so many brownfield sites and brown sites and buildings that can be redeveloped? You know, we have to preserve all our green spaces now. Oxygen is at a premium, for goodness sake. You know, we should be lowering carbon footprint, not flipping, tarmacking everything over. But anyway, so yeah, that is a group that I have, yeah, recently been in that has been jubilant. Woohoo!
That's fantastic. Right, next question. And I don't know whether you've had any other jobs. What other jobs did you do apart from showbiz? Have you done anything else?
I scooped ice creams in Ealing Broadway Centre.
Did you?
Yeah, I did. On Papa Ronaldo's ice cream cart. And I've obviously got a very good future in ice cream scooping, because I also scooped ice creams in Leicester Square, in Haagen-Dazs, the flagship store, which was, oh my God, I was paid like £2.50 an hour to do that. And it sounds really nice, like you just scoop ice creams, but you have to change these big vats of ice cream for the cold storage. They're really massive and heavy. And then if you get the late shift, you have to like mop up the scungy ice cream sodden floor. And then another job I had was I worked for Q magazine, the music magazine. Yeah. I was editorial assistant on that for a bit. There we go. So those are all sort of, yeah, part-time summer jobs and Saturday jobs. Oh, and I fitted shoes in Russell and Bromley as well.
I've always thought that job must be horrific because of people's feet. And
yeah, I know. Yeah. I mean, the lucky thing is I was in grown-up sort of fit their own shoes, really, and you just go and get the box and put the tissue paper on the top and then take it to the till. But I remember, because I was in Ealing, and weirdly, so that was my Saturday job, and I remember that like Philip Schofield, Simon Parkin and Philippa Forrest, they all used to sort of live in Ealing or hang out in Ealing. So yeah, I saw them all and working in this job, like walking past stuff. I don't know if that's even relevant, but it's before I was in TV. Maybe they inspired me to go and do that thing myself.
Who was the first? We were discussing this the other day, on an ad break in my show. Who's the first famous person you remember seeing? Can I tell you mine quickly?
Yeah, go for it.
I remember I'd driven to London with my parents. I can't remember where we were going, and we pulled up alongside Hyde Park, and I looked over, and there's a Rolls Royce, and in the back of it was Kenny Everett. And oh, I could not believe I'd seen Kenny Everett. And it was like, because I came from out of London and Hertfordshire. Mm. And I couldn't believe I'd seen someone famous. And I kept telling everybody, I've seen someone famous. It was like absolutely incredible. And I remember it so vividly. I still remember it now, thinking I've actually done it. I've seen someone famous.
And he was really famous because there were only like four channels back then.
Yeah.
Or three channels. Like Kenny Everett was really popular, wasn't he?
Who was the first famous person you saw? Do you remember?
John Craven.
Oh, that's cool. But didn't you work with him on Newsround?
Yeah, he opened Ealing Broadway Shopping Centre and was signing autographs.
Did you end up on Newsround doing reporting or something?
Oh, me? Sorry, I missed what you said. I wasn't sure. Yeah. Do you know what? They came to our school looking for people. It's before the general election of 1992, and we had to go and ask Neil Kinnock a question, and I was asking him a question on behalf of the Green Party, I was asking him about nuclear disarmament. But yes, I remember that was really fun because I got to go to TV Centre for the first time. Maybe that's what gave me the bug, the now defunct BBC Television Centre. And I remember I met the presenters of Newsround, Julie Etchingham, and we went and had pizza in Pizza Express. It was very exciting. Woohoo! Yeah.
All right. So what is your outstanding fashion moment? Could be good or bad.
Outstanding. I mean, okay. So So I remember, like, I've never been very much into fashion. And I remember, you know, I was on Blue Peter at the time, and my agent had said, "I've got we've got tickets in the office to a premiere." And I think I'd never been to a premiere. I think it was Spider-Man or something. Not been to a premiere before. Very exciting stuff. Or maybe I'd been to one or two, but as a Blue Peter presenter, it's not really what you do, go to premieres. Anyway, so I went to meet my agent in their offices, which were off Leicester Square, and to go to this premiere, and they were like, "You can't wear that dress." And I was like, "Why not? This is my Topshop dress." And they were like, "You can't go down a red carpet in that dress. I think it's a very nice dress." So anyway, my agent, who also looked after Mylene Class, then said, "No, here, wear this dress. It's been sent for Mylene," and put me in this dress, which, like, was really well, I didn't notice at the time, but if you lean forward, it gaped. And there was just photos of me in all the papers for wearing this revealing dress, like Blue Peter presented. And it wasn't even revealing. It was the sort of side angle that they'd got. And that sort of picture was haunting me for years.
Do you know what? I've always said it's a lot tougher being a female presenter than a male presenter. Because, look, you know, I go on TV, people will go, "Oh, Tim, you look an ass," or whatever. But very rarely do people pick me apart. Every single time a woman turns up on TV, she is analysed within an inch of her life with what she's wearing, what her hair's like, what her makeup's like. Often by other women, it's got to be said. But women are just judged on the way they look constantly. Whereas I'll be more judged on the crap which comes out of my mouth. You'll be judged on what you look like.
It's so true. Men can be a silver fox, you know, like, "Oh, he's so handsome now, he's aged and matured." Whereas sort of women, they, you can never get a silver lady, do you? You know, it's like, you feel very quickly like you're sort of over the hill and not attractive anymore. Whereas, you know, because men often date people younger than them, if you think about it, every year, a fresh crop of 18-year-olds is now in adulthood that can date, you know, older men, whereas women get slagged off for being a cougar if they go out with a younger man, which is kind of like, hang on a sec, surely it cuts both ways, which means that every year, as men are being sort of snapped off the market, getting older and being married or, you know, being in a long-term relationship, the pool gets smaller for women, whereas the pool gets bigger for men every year. And I always think it's unfair.
What they say, Connie, is it's half your age. For a man, it's half your age plus 7. So as you get older, you're 60, it's 37. That's pretty cool.
Right, okay.
Do you know, I've got a funny story to tell you. I was invited to the O2 to watch the Rolling Stones, and I thought, I'd like to see that. I'm in this box, and there's this very attractive sort of older lady stood in our box, and it was really sweet. And she was talking so fondly about Mick Jagger that eventually I said, "How do you know Mick Jagger? Do you know, you related to him something?" And she said, "No, I used to be his girlfriend years ago." And I just thought, it's so funny, his girlfriends have stayed the same age.
Yeah.
And I was talking to her, really, she was really attractive, but she was an older lady, like really older. And I was like, at one stage, she was the young thing on his arm. And
such a good point, because if you think of these sort of rockers, like, really, you know, Mick Jagger's old girlfriends now should be sort of like, you know, gray haired with this sort of, maybe, you know, because he is older. But like we say, men don't have that issue, do they? Really, they can sort of, they're still considered attractive in old age, whereas I don't feel women are as much by the same token.
Okay, leads us nicely onto the next question. What do you do to keep fit?
Okay, so basically, this is going to sound mad, but I'm one of these people that I love everything to be multitasking, two for the price of one. So I used to sometimes have to, on Blue Peter, like, be told, like, "Oh my gosh, you're going to go training with the Royal Marines." And I hate going to a gym, and I can't do running or whatever. So what I do to keep fit is It's Connie Hark's home exercising. What it is it's three things in tandem with a couple of other things thrown in. So number one, what I do is whenever I remember, so I could be doing it now, I am actually doing it now, I clench my stomach as hard as I can until it hurts. And you clench it for as long as possible until you can't bear it anymore, long and hard as possible. As soon as you can't bear it, just relax. And do it all the time, whenever you can remember. Usually it'd be like you're going training with the Royal Marines in 2 months or in 3 weeks or whatever. There's a time limit. Also, when you're sitting down, you raise your feet off the ground, but by only a millimeter, right? Or if you're lying on a bed even. So whenever if I'm on the phone to someone, I could be clenching my stomach and doing that thing of raising my feet off the ground. Or even if you're lying in bed watching telly, or if you're sitting on a sofa, you can do it all the time, as much as possible. When it's painful, just relax. Each time you do it, you can do it for longer. Also, I would start doing press-ups, but you start on a really vertical surface, so even the wall or whatever, and you have to do 60 press-ups, right? Or 30, whatever your benchmark is. And then once it starts hurting or you can't do anymore, just relax. But every time you remember, try and do it again. Right. And slowly, once you've nailed it, 30 against the wall or the high bookshelf, then you can go a bit lower. The kitchen counter, you slowly work your way lower. The coffee table, you work your way lower. You do all these three things in tandem. And then as well as that, you can just do things like triceps and stuff. But it's all at home while you're doing other stuff, watching TV on the phone. So it means you're doing it all the time. And I would work my way up till I could do 30 men's press ups. And that's what I would do. But all the time, it's really good because you don't have to go to a gym. No one else has to see you. You can do it while you're doing a podcast. I'm clenching my stomach now, or while you're walking to the shops, you know, and it makes your core really strong. The only thing is cardio, you know, obviously The cardio is the big, but you can get to doing 30 men's press-ups quite easy if you go at it. Every time you remember, you might need to put reminders on your phone. You just do it, but you could do it anyway. When you're driving the car, you can be clenching that stomach. Get your core really strong.
Connie, I love this advice, but I'm going to tell my daughters on you for calling them men's press-ups.
What I mean by men's, you're right.
You know what you mean, but you can't call them that, Connie. Come on.
Yeah, I'm from an elderly generation. Because I only had to clarify that, because some people might cop out and do the ones with their legs bent. Okay. So I just had to, and there was no other way to clarify. I could have said press-ups where you have your legs straight, I guess, but that takes up more time. But now I've taken up the more time anyway, so I might as well have done that. Shame on me.
All right. Tell our listeners something that's been life-changing for you. Things like this is like some meeting someone or a teacher giving you confidence, or a producer who believed in you, or I don't know, something happening to your family or something. What's been life-changing?
Okay. What was life-changing for me is doing filming with Blue Peter, where we went to this village in Africa where everyone is so poor that they have to barter everything. So there's no money. And then we went to pay them. We'd done this interview with this family. And literally, we had to go on this Man from Del Monte four-seater plane. I thought it was going to fall out of the sky. It's literally a tin can with wings. We got dropped in a field where we were told there was no mobile phones either. We had this clunky satellite phone. We were told in a week's time, you have to come and stand in this field at this time, look in the sky, and this plane, this tin can with wings, will come and it will land in this field and take you back to civilization. So we got dropped in this field, had to walk for miles, lugging all the camera kit, went to this remote village where they barter everything. I did this interview, went to pay them when we'd given them, we got cooking oil, rice, you know, stuff that they can use that's handy. And then this argument broke out and we were like, what are they arguing over? And they were arguing over the carrier bag that we'd bought it in, you know, and it wasn't even like a, you know, Hessian bag for life or whatever. It's just like quite a durable, sturdy carrier bag. And I remember when I went home from that trip, like, there was a Big Brother helpline for people having withdrawal symptoms from Big Brother. There was a guy jumping off this building at King's Cross and they'd cordoned off the road. And I said to this like Nigerian cab driver, like, what's going on? And he said, there's a man wanting to jump. If this was where I come from, they'd just let him jump. And it's true. We're so privileged. We live in a world where we can stand on a building and the Samaritans will say, don't do it. And people will care and come out and stop us from jumping. And everything after that trip seemed weird. Like, you buy wrapping paper for a few quid to put on a present and then rip it off again. You know, and everything, that's when I realized that, you know, we just treat everything as disposable. And that was a trip where they wanted your plastic water bottle and they wanted your biro, and they value everything. And they value anything with a bright color, like say your mic cover is bright red, you know, that's been dyed bright red, and that bright color means that it's sort of valuable and worth something rather than just a brownie dirt, you know. And that's the thing, you know, we live in a society where we can have carrier bags and disposable things that are bright colors, yet they, to them, that's sort of got monetary value.
And Blue Peter's been so amazing, hasn't it, for you? You've seen so much and learned so much and experienced so much. What an amazing thing to have in your life.
Yeah, it's mental. And it was at the time, it was a third of my life. Because, you know, well, when I started, I'd lived for 2 decades only. And then I did another decade on that show. So, yeah, it's a bit weird.
I'm going to jump to a question here because I think this is really interesting, because I think I've got a good answer for you after your answer. What's it like to be famous?
You know what? I never think of myself as famous.
Really. Oh, you are.
I mean, I suppose I am because of... I mean, yeah, I suppose because people know who I am, but weirdly, I don't know. I just think if people are, I don't know, I don't feel famous because most of my friends aren't famous, and I don't really do things particularly like go to premieres or whatever. We'll go to an odd awards ceremony to, you know, if Charlie's nominated for an award or whatever. But I would say my life is really quite pretty relatively normal. And so I don't think of myself as famous, but I do often think, you know, and also one good thing actually about being a girl is that you can sort of hide under your hair or put a cap. I do think if you want to be famous, like you must agree with this, Tim. If you're in a situation and you want to be recognised, you can be recognised. It's kind of how you hold yourself almost, and whether you have eye contact with people, whether they recognise you. But if you want to go to the shops and just be, you know, you can go around. It's sort of body language as well, and how you hold yourself, and, you know, whether you've got a cap on and loads of things. And I think there's certain people that really want to be famous and they want to be recognised and they get that buzz, you know. So weirdly, I kind of, and then if you act not famous, then people sort of stop treating you as famous. So I don't know, my kids just go to the regular state school. It's got a 4-class intake. And, you know, maybe at first it was like, oh, she's that woman off Blue Peter or whatever. But now no one really could give a beep about me, you know.
All right. By the way, I've got to say, you mentioned Charlie there. It's Charlie Brooker, your husband, for people who don't know.
Yes, sorry, I assume not.
He wins a lot of awards because his shows are bloody brilliant, aren't they? So he's a fantastic writer. I was going to say, there was a musician, a rock star, let's call him, who said to me once, the thing about having fame, which I thought applies to this conversation we're having here. I'm not going to say who it is, because he said it gives you the keys to meet the royal family and the high echelons of life, but also you can also hang out with the drug dealers and criminals if you want. It gives you the keys to meet and hang out with everyone. And I always thought that's quite interesting, that people like having famous people around. So it means you can go and, I mean, I don't have your fame, but...
I think you're definitely a household name that young people don't really know who I am, if you think about it, but young people know who you are.
But I think what it does is our jobs give us a key to go and do things. Like I've been to Zambia with work, and so I've witnessed some stuff there, like you said you've witnessed, and it's quite nice to see things and have experiences and
definitely
molds you. And the idea
and people know you know, they know your personality, especially because you're a presenter. I think if you're an actor or an actress, it's different, but me and you are just who we are really on telly. And I know, and more so because we do live, I think, because you get to put yourself into that. It's, you know,
do you miss doing live TV? Because whenever you come on the show, you have like a lovely sparkle in your eyes because you seem to really enjoy being in the
studio. Oh my gosh.
And I love doing live TV. I just love it. It's a buzz for me. The best thing ever.
It's the best. Live TV is the best. And actually, I don't enjoy doing pre-recorded TV.
Nor do I.
Because I don't like it because often a script will be written how you might not want to say it. I just remember doing this program, actually. This is just an example. And it was a docu-soap about a zoo, essentially, but with links. And I remember they wanted me to say it at the beginning and they kept wanting me to say after the ad break, "Hi, I'm Connie Huck. You're watching..." I can't even remember, Zoo Days or whatever it's called. And I really used to think that's like Troy McClure off the city. You know that spoof, "Hi, I'm Troy McClure." You might know me from programs such as Buildings Fall Down. But kind of it's not about us, you know. And I kind of, there's certain things where I cringe. Actually, even on the books, I sort of cringe where it says Connie Huck in big letters. And I said, no, I don't want to have that. But obviously they want to market the books with your name, but kind of that's not a quality either. But you're absolutely right that, you know, being known or being famous does open so many doors, rightly or wrongly so.
I was gonna say the problem with pre-recorded TV for me is it gives the cameramen and the sound men, love you all by the way if you're listening to this, but it gives them the chance to go, "Can you do one more for me?" And it's like, "No, go, no, you can't, sort of." And I remember in a racing car once and coming around this track and the guy had hurtled around and I got out and I was terrified and I got out and went, "Oh my God." And then the sound man goes, "Is it all right, do one more for me?"
I can't
recreate that, you arsehole. It's like, All right, next question. Go on.
Because I could talk forever about live TV. Carry on. Let's move on.
All right. Have you ever seen a ghost or a UFO? A change of gear here. I've never seen either. Do you believe in conspiracy theories? Do you believe in any?
You know what? I have to say, you know, what with sort of, Trump and Brexit and all of these things that seem to align, and Russia and their dealings, and, you know, things that seem to be only in James Bond films, you know, do seem like, you know, I by design, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but there's certain conspiracy theories that could maybe be true. And I'm just saying, you know, now that Nigel Farage has got this new party, and I don't know, I do feel that there's things going on behind the scenes sometimes that we're not aware of. And I don't necessarily call that conspiracy theory. It might be just the ignorance on our part. But I do, that is one thing where I could believe there's allegiances happening and manipulation behind the scenes.
I think we should, I think it was the Pirate Party, which used to poll quite highly in Northern Europe. I think one of their policies was you're not allowed to have secrets or lie to the public. It's an imprisonment if they got in power. And I always used to think everyone go, "Oh, you can't do that because you've got to have your secrets." It's like, why? Like, tell us the truth. You know, maybe it's a good thing that all politicians actually literally have to tell us what they're at. What they're doing. But everyone will go, anti-terrorism, you can't do it. So
I find it bonkers that we don't know how many children our own prime minister has. You know,
it's insane, isn't it?
It's insane. It's madness. Yeah. That's just something you ask when you might meet a new person that's a friend. Yeah. How many kids have you got? It's just mental.
What's interesting also is, your husband Charlie writes Black Mirror, and I think you've written one, haven't you? Or did you?
Yeah, I wrote on the first series, which was the Channel 4 series pre Netflix.
It's getting too close to reality, though, isn't it? All this stuff that he's written about. I mean, it's like really, really quite close to what we're living through.
I know. Well, you know what's really weird? If you think about it, humans didn't change much for millions and millions of years. But now, with the advent of sort of technology, every new change brings a million more. So the graph has sort of gone like that, this isn't a visual medium, is it? But it's been on a sort of shallow diagonal, and suddenly we're almost vertical. In that, I remember being a kid, and you must have thought this as a kid, thinking everything is so modern compared to when my parents were growing up, and, you know, pre-wartime, what more can possibly happen? You know, and I used to think, like, maybe video calls, but that's about it. And will that actually catch on? But actually, with smartphones and, you know, click and collect, and that's not what I mean, you know, where you pay Apple Pay or whatever, you know, everything can be smart. You can have a smart dustbin. And it just feels like we're, all his things are coming true almost, because the it's supposed to be near future dystopian scenarios, but near future is almost the present now, because things change is happening at such a fast pace. You know, we're going to have driverless cars soon, AI, you know, it's actually quite scary. Do you remember the film Electric Dreams?
I don't remember what happened in it, but I remember the...
But basically, it's a really old film from when that song was out, you know, that Phil Oakey song, We'll Always Be Together,
yeah.
Together in Electric Dreams. So basically, it's about a computer, but it's essentially about, really, computers and the internet gaining consciousness, which is something that totally could happen. If everything is communicating with everything else, there could come a point where we put all of the information in these things surrounding us that can all communicate with each other, and one button will be flicked and suddenly humans will become obsolete because technology will take over.
Well, Elon Musk always says, and I quite like Elon, he always says, the closer we get to simulating the universe, the closer we get to realizing we're a simulation. And I thought, it's intrigued me that, because we are getting quite close to it. And it does seem that, you know, it's not unimaginable now that we could simulate a universe, is it? So yeah, maybe we are just simulations. All right.
And if we are, does it matter? Who knows? Anyway, sorry, carry on.
No, we'll get to that, because that could be the last question. Is there something you've changed your mind about? And this question's always a big one for me, because since I did this podcast, I'm really pro drug reform now. I'm not pushing you down that route, by the way, but it really changed my mind massively. And then there's so many other things I've learned from doing my podcast. I've gone, oh, I now get it. And so I'm very open to having my mind changed. Is there anything you've really changed your mind about?
It would have to be that the thing of, I've really changed my mind on, I said, like, I'm really not consumers. I used to be really into, in my 20s, I bought into all of that 100%, you know, and I want to be impressive and look impressive and impress people. And, you know, that I would say is my biggest U-turn, sort of being able to be confident, to be able to, I don't know, go out and like have gray hairs or whatever and not feel the need that, oh my god, there's gray hairs showing, or just be scruffy or be me, or you know, and not worry what other people think, because I'm confident enough in me and I only want people that like me for me to be surrounding me almost. And if they're going to be judgmental, or you know what you were saying about people, women getting abused for the way they look or whatever, yeah, it's a reflection of the people, you know. And that is quite an important thing to realize. If people are being horrible about other people, it's the victim really is kind of, it's the people, the abusers kind of, that are the ones that are probably really unhappy.
The one thing I don't get about when you talk about material things is fast fashion. That's the one that really, everyone seems to understand that fast fashion is not great for the world and disposable clothes are not fantastic for the world.
Mm.
The guys who are doing it are living on yachts, not paying any tax and tax havens, although, so that's not attractive either. And yet for some reason, everyone still seems to be buying into it, the cheap fashion, the cheap clothes. And I still can't get my head around why people aren't making more of a stand on that. It's just the one that I don't quite get my head around.
I'm sure
I buy some fast fashion too, by the way. So I'm not, you know, I'm not a saint.
Yeah. You're not but saying
I,
you're a saint.
But I do like to buy some quality, which I think will last. But
yeah, but weirdly, you know, I have. So remember, I haven't bought clothes for well over 10 years. I have got things that were fast fashion that I still wear now. And right, you're right in that it's anything. So people seem to think, oh, well, if I buy wooden toys for my kids, that's good. And it is good. But anything is fine if you use it for years and years and years. And yeah, go on.
Did you just say you haven't bought any clothes for 10 years?
Oh, did you not know this? This whole thing. Yeah, no. So basically... yeah, I haven't bought clothes for over 10 years because I don't need any more clothes, because like I said to you, I bought into all that stuff. So I used to be into fashion and have all that stuff, and I haven't grown, you know. So, you know, I still fit all those clothes. So instead of buying new ones, I just, you know,
aren't the shapes like the jeans have changed? Actually, you're probably back in fashion. The jeans,
yeah, that's everything comes back in fashion. That's the thing. But you know, so I mentioned this in passing on Loose Women. I think it was earlier this year, and then all these sort of Daily Mail online and all this started digging up photos where they realised, and you see, no one noticed before. Like, they've got pictures of me at something in 2010, and it's the same outfit that I'm wearing in 2020.
That's amazing. See,
but no one noticed before they went through their pictures to research that. So, and this is the thing, it's like, nobody notices if you're wearing the same thing again, really.
There was a Hollywood, was it Tiffany Haddish or someone, one of those actors who said, I bought a dress. They kept on saying, you've worn the same dress at a premiere. And she said, I bought this dress. I look really good in it. It cost me a lot of money and I'm going to wear it. And I just loved it that she was doing it. Because again, men don't have to worry. We just wear the same suit, don't we? Every time we go. I've had one black suit, black tie suit, which I've worn for 15 years or something.
Yeah,
women have to wear,
and it does the job. You know, this is it, and that's why I quite like lockdown as well, because I can just go around in my jogging bottoms, not being judged. And now post lockdown, even though we're going into a new one, I've got the, you know, I'm happy to wear my jogging bottoms out and be judged because I'm happy in me. But what I was just going to say is, I went. And saw a friend who I'd converted to my mentality. She doesn't really buy any new clothes either. And she used to, you know, she was used to be the deputy editor of In Style magazine. So she used to buy into all that stuff as well. And we went to see a third friend of ours. And this third friend was like, oh, I love your top. And she was like, oh, well, this is 5 years old from such and such place. And I went, well, this is 10 years old from such and such place. And I thought, and I said, there is a world in which people will try and top Trump each other by how old their clothes are. And there was this thing in Sweden called lagom, which became really fashionable. And lagom means just the right amount, where people only need to have the right amount. But it was really fashionable in the same way that sort of keep calm and carry on mentality and upcycling has come into fashion now. And I can imagine a world in which there's a Sunday Times rich list, but it's the give back list instead. So it's like these millionaires trying to outdo each other by how much they're giving back to charity, because people just want to impress each other. And keeping up with the Joneses isn't to do with anything other than the benchmarks we set. So if I'd come on your podcast now and I'd said, look, Tim, I'm wearing my 24 karat gold T-shirt, you'd think, oh, that's a bit much. But there is a world in which 20 pairs of shoes could be deemed a bit much, or 10 pairs, or whatever the benchmark we set. But it has to start with the kids, you know. And because grown-ups are so ingrained, it takes years of marketing and PR to get them to change mobile phone network, or, you know, things that have gone into you young, like, I don't know, using that brand of toothpaste or whatever. They're so ingrained, it's hard to change them. So
You know what I've always found weird is looking at sort of footballers and some of the music scene, how they do this bragging thing where they go and get a, I don't know whether it will carry on after coronavirus, but I found it always a bit weird that the people going to watch football aren't the richest in the world, maybe. And yet they've got their Ferrari and they've wrapped it purple or something, and they've got a fleet of cars and they've got this watches and these things. And I've always thought it would turn the fans off, but for some reason, like, or the Kardashians, if you look at that, I would have always thought it would, the influencers, when they're pretending to drive on private jets and stuff, I would have always thought, you know, it turns me off. I'm like, I just wouldn't.
I guarantee it, Tim. It turns you off because it's something to do with your upbringing in your primary years. Like, your barometer or your sort of levels are set to a certain thing, which, like I say, in your 20s, it's too late. We're really fixed. But something in your upbringing gave you that mentality.
Could it not be the fact that I actually have a decent job and a decent living and earn enough money, and then people who don't are aspiring and going, well, look, I don't have as much as, so maybe it's quite, you know, they go, I'd like to have a Ferrari, which is
but rather. Why do people want a Ferrari? They want a Ferrari because other people will be impressed.
Yeah, maybe.
You know, it's the thing of Well, private number plates are the ones that really get me, because what is the reason for having a private? You pay money.
Oh, this would be so embarrassing if I had a private number plate now. I don't.
But you're so. I know you'd agree with me, even if you did, and you'd laugh at yourself, because I know you as a person, and I, you know, over the years I've sort of gauged that we're kind of on the same wavelength. But the point is, with a private number plate, you've paid for this private number plate just to say, hey, look, I've got so much money, I've bought this private number plate. And it's all to do with impressing other people. But if the other people were impressed by your, you know, your number plate not being private, then you'd go for that, if you see what I mean. If it was NAFTA. So there's certain realms in which a private number plate is NAFTA, certain tribes, as you call it. And so I would be mortified to have one, because I know that my friends who are like-minded would judge me on that. So we're all judging, and it's just what I say is sort of the benchmark. It's the standards we're judging on, which is to do with your tribe and your upbringing. And
it's a tough conversation to have, though, isn't it? Because I know that there will be people listening who go, God, I just love the sort of money that Tim and Connie have had, and then I could be picky and choosy. And that's sort of where people come from, don't they?
Yeah, and they're totally entitled to that. And you can't enforce it on other people, because like I'm saying, you can only make the change in kids.
And I have to be honest with you, I interviewed James Doty the other day, and he's written this great book called Into the Magic Shop. And he was at once worth 75, he actually corrected me and said it was $78 million. And he kind of lost it all overnight. And he was happier because he ends up doing a lot of, he runs the Institute for Compassion in America now.
Yeah.
He's a brain surgeon. He's a great guy. And he's exactly the point you're making. Giving is a lot better than having. But there is this bit inside me which goes, do you know what? I'd like to have $78 million. And then, I probably would use it for good, but I'd like to have the experience of trying to have $78 million. There's a bit of me. But then there's another part of me which thinks, oh, the responsibility of all that money.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
No, but we're all allowed to want the $78 million, and we're all allowed to have it. But the point is that if you just squander it on what... So I have this thing, Tim, I call it dead money. So when you make a purchase, if you're buying a house, it could appreciate, right? So you bought a house, it's a sensible investment, it's appreciated. When you die, you'll bequeath it, and you can give some to your kids, and you can still give some to charity. Right. If you're buying these clothes, this fast fashion, right, yeah, you can donate it to a charity shop or whatever. But essentially, there's enough clothes out there, and essentially lots of it ends up going into landfill. You know, and same with toys. Toys are the worst, these plastic toys. They're coming to the house.
I hate that.
And there's bits of unidentifiable plastic you don't know belongs to what toy, what game, and it's just landfill. And it's even worse because it's made out of man-made substances. Plastics do not break down, and so that's what I call dead money, because that money will never save a life, whereas the money you put in the house will save a life. The money you buy a top with that's for a job interview where you get the job is, again, it's an investment. But you have to deem what is the money that is frivolous and squandered, and what is the money that will help you to make more money that can do good, if that makes sense. Mm. So that's why plastic going into landfill is the worst, because it's dead money. That money will never go to charity. It will never save lives. It will be a toy that was maybe played with for like a couple of weeks and then gone. And same with sort of, you know, your old iPhone. Or, my phone, I just need it to do certain things. I don't need eyeball recognition, because I'm paying all that money. And unless Apple are going to give loads of money to charity, you know, Jeff Bezos, if he's going to become a Bill Gates, at least I can feel a bit better about it. But I don't have an Amazon account, because, you know, it's too easy to go click, click, click and buy things. And that's the problem. Everything is so easy that we don't value it, and everything becomes disposable.
What do you mean you want Jeff Bezos to become like Bill Gates?
Well, no, what I mean is, sorry, my screensaver's gone. Yeah, I want, during Corona, COVID, his income has gone up so much that, isn't it, there's some weird stat that if he gave all of his employees a zillion billion dollar pay rise or something, he'd still be richer than he was before the virus broke out. As long as he's going to give that back when he goes to good causes, or invest it in good things.
This is my problem. By the way, it's something like if you earned £180,000 every day from the day Jesus was born, you still wouldn't be as rich as Jeff Bezos.
It's mad. There's so many of these Jeff Bezos stats going on.
It's incredible. But the problem with I have with this is when we the world we've created now, when we let people like him amass these huge wealth, Bill Gates, for instance, as well, then they go, I'm going to give my money away to charity, which they do. They do good causes. You know, I think Warren Buffett and Bill Gates are together doing it. But then they're playing God with the money and they're making the decision on where the money should go. So I know Bill Gates is trying to eradicate malaria from Africa, which is fantastic. But he's chosen that over any other project. And it's like, wow, how does he get to make that decision? That's what I mean. About having that,
but that's the privilege of having the money.
Yeah, but I wouldn't want that responsibility.
Yeah, but then if you don't, you can give it to someone else to have the responsibility. So,
which is what Warren Buffett has done. He's given all his money to Bill Gates, hasn't he?
So he gives. And he's amazing in himself because Warren Buffett, he could have given loads to his kids, but instead, and he lives in the same house, you know, he could have bought a million mansions and, you know, and he's told his kids that you can work for a charitable thing and then you can earn this money. It's like almost putting sort of caveats on stuff. But, you know, I do think so that within a capitalist framework, it can still be making more money can be for good. It's just when you get greedy people that, you know, essentially do the dead money thing. You need to sort of have a trickle down, you know, a responsible way of dispersing it all. And also, we don't really need billionaires, do we? I just don't think there is a need for billionaires. What do you do when you've got that much money? Like you're saying, the pressure is for their own mental happiness. Like you're saying, we'll be doing billionaires a favor if we just ban them, because they can't be normal in the head with that pressure hanging over them.
There's got to be a new system in place at some stage to redistribute the wealth around the world. That is for sure. Connie, I'm very conscious I've taken up a lot of your time. We never got to ask 19 questions.
Oh no.
But it's fine because they're
all... Edit all the worthy bit out and let's just do the fun questions. This has turned into... Like, we've been putting the world to rights.
I like it. My listeners will enjoy it. And I love your principles, you sure? By the way. Have you ever seen the documentary or the book called The Minimalists?
Yes.
That's because I really fell in love with that. And I've tried my hardest now to... So I say to all my friends, I'm on a WhatsApp group with my friends, they keep putting cars up and products they want, like flat screen TVs. And I keep saying, guys, we're supposed to be getting rid of stuff, not getting more stuff. Yeah. You know, the less you have, the happier you'll be.
And the thing about these technologies is that they're obsolete so quickly that they're turning disposable. It's crazy, isn't it?
I think it moves so quickly. We're going to go back to renting. I remember with my first ever flat, I rented a TV. And I reckon we'll go back to that.
Yeah, radio rentals.
Yeah, things will move around. Why not rent everything in your life? Apparently you can start renting dresses as well now, my kids told me. So if you want to go out for a night out, rather than buy a dress, you rent one. Sounds quite gross in a way that you're wearing somebody else's dress, but I think it's quite a good idea as well.
I don't think it's only gross because we're so into ownership that we think that stuff is gross. If you think going back generations, we lived in the dirt. I'm not saying let's all live in the dirt, but we've got to a point where, you know, some people's houses, you know, everything is spotless and they don't even have a possession, not a book on a shelf, or, you know, we're going to a point where actually it's okay to sort of bring standards down a bit because it equalizes things a lot more. If you see what I mean. Oh no, I wanted to do the fun, frivolous questions. I was adamant that I wouldn't go deep and heavy and preachy.
It's been brilliant. Right, I'm gonna ask you the last question though. The idea of this podcast, I asked you 19 questions. If I like your answers enough, you get the bonus question. I'm gonna ask you the bonus question anyway, because it's the one that I like to ask people. What is the meaning of life, Connie Huck?
The meaning of life. Life has no meaning. Isn't that a tough, bitter pill to swallow? Just enjoy the ride. Happiness. Enjoy the ride. You know, there's too many people that stress about too many things. And actually, stress is, you know, brings on illness and mental health problems and whatever. Just try and see the silver linings and enjoy the ride. And remember, there's always people worse off than yourself. So, you know, in a weird way, you'll frazzle your head looking for the meaning of life. But all you can do is enjoy the ride and get as much happiness on that ride along the way as you can.
Connie, I love your thought processes. It's very, it's refreshing listening to you. I love it. It's really good.
Oh, really, thanks, lovely. I was worried that it'd been all preachy and heavy.
No, I love it. No, I love it because that's what my whole podcast started off as an agony column where I answer people's agony uncle column where I answer people's questions. And it's like the stuff that you're saying is stuff that I've learned through my little journey here. Well, I hate using that word, but all my listeners who've listened from the beginning, this is sort of stuff we've discovered, which is, you know, where happiness lies and stuff. So you've obviously been going through the same sort of
existential
exactly. All right, I'm gonna finish by giving your book another name check. It's Fearless Fairy Tales. Probably be a great present for Christmas for people. What age group is it aimed at again?
So you can read it to your kids from 4, but to get the sort of humor and stuff like that, I would say 8. Well, to read for yourself rather, I would say 8 years up.
Perfect.
But adults like it too. Trumpelstiltskin is a grown-up book, right, which is great for Secret Santa and stocking fillers. But yeah, if you want your kids to have the right values and grow up happy, Fearless Fairy Tales. That's when to do it.
Connie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We should do this again because it was lovely. So,
we should. Yeah. I'm up for that.
All right.
Cheers.
Thanks a lot.
Dear Lovejoy is written and hosted by Tim Lovejoy and produced by Blake Fallows. It's brought to you by Cooker, spelled Quooker. Check them out at cooker.co.uk. That's spelled Q-U-O-O-K-E-R. If you want to get in touch with Tim, email dearlovejoy@gmail.com. And Tim is on Twitter @TimLovejoy and on Instagram @TimLovejoy_official.